Welcome back to the Codex Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Endless Odyssey. This is episode 6 and part 2 of season 2 of the show, in which we continue our reading of You Died, the Dark Souls Companion. I've got no announcements for you today, and I'm not sure that we'll be doing the sort of previously on style recaps this season that we did in season 1, simply for the reason that it wouldn't make much sense for this particular text, given that there isn't really a linear narrative present, except for the general story of this is what we think is cool about Dark Souls. That said, I'm really enjoying the reading so far, and I'm excited to continue, so without further ado, I give you part 2 of You Died, the Dark Souls Companion, by Jason Killingsworth and Keesa MacDonald. You've Got Chainmail, Lordran's First Victims, by Jason Killingsworth. September 19th, 2011, 12:41 a.m. I'm trying to work out in which order you're meant to do the stages, reads a despairing late-night email from Rich McCormick, who's busy playing Dark Souls so he can write a review for the UK edition of PC Gamer. Quote, I'm coming to the sad realization the game doesn't want you to do any of them. It just wants to sit above you and launch apple cores at your face while going, ner ner ner. Every new enemy fills me with dread. I used to think the Cape Knights were bad, but I can usually get rid of them without taking damage now. Bar the rapier buckler ones, anyway, who seem more erratic and unsuited to my pokey man. Even those tree men started off bad. I got too close to one and he chewed my head from my neck. If ignorance is bliss, we should have been euphoric. Yet here we all were, stressing out, grinding our teeth to powder. It was late at night, but the majority of us were awake in our respective domiciles, wired, all of us playing Dark Souls. The game's Japanese release date was just 2 days off, and it wouldn't be hitting shelves in Europe until the very end of October. Due to the fact that we'd taken assignments reviewing Dark Souls for various magazines and websites, the game's publisher, Bandai Namco, sent us advance copies of the game to play weeks ahead of release. When you need to vent, you crave empathy, and Rich only had a few people that would read his email and know the precise contours of the pain he was describing. For many, it's hard to imagine a world before the Dark Souls wikis arrived, those encyclopedic libraries of information explaining every last bit of minutia, the location of every item, the secret to roller skating over each boss, the exact layout of every area, the nuances of the covenants governing the game's PvP and co-op interactions, and which merchants sell what. Just as it's hard to believe that, if you trace anyone's family tree back far enough, you'll reach a generation with no access to maps. No idea what lay across oceans or beyond distant mountains. In the absence of external references and support literature, oral tradition quickly takes over. Social connections aren't just a warm feeling of camaraderie in that context, they can often dictate one's chances of survival. That was certainly true as we stumbled onto Lordran's doorstep together and started pressing toward its uncharted interior. From Keesa MacDonald, sent September 24th, 2011, 1725. Ugh, God, Sen's Fortress. Got to the point where I can't even do the easy bits anymore. My nerves are in such shreds. Can't get online either. Gutting. I'm really dispirited after 4 continuous days of this. From Michael Gapper, sent 25th of September, 2011, 1349. About 8 hours in and I've managed to link the starting area of Firelink Shrine with the Undead Parish, elevator in the Gargoyle Church, and the Dragon Bridge with the Lower Burg, basement key found on the way to Gargoyle Church, and the Lower Burg with Firelink, the gate in the aqueduct where the zombie guy is selling poison remedies. Game's really opening up now, and all the connections between areas are just beautiful, really tight design. It's still cruel and unfair and a bit cheaty in too many ways, mind you. The enemies don't really play by the same rules as players, but the world is an impeccable piece of work, one of the best game spaces I've ever played in. From Keesa MacDonald, sent September 25th, 2011, 1638. I'm gonna have to throw in the towel, friends. I can't do Smo and Ornstein without help. With a decent helper, one of us on each boss, this fight wouldn't be so bad. As it is, it's just impossible. My co-author, Kiza, who was working for IGN at the time, dubbed our email support group the Chain of Pain. At the outset, we were a party of three, but word quickly spread and new reviewers expressed interest in joining. The thread expanded, welcoming journalists from all sorts of outlets in both the U.S. and the United Kingdom. We worked for competing publications, but we considered ourselves allies, united by common enemies such as the Taurus Demon, Darkroots Hydra, Smo, and Ornstein. I was living in Bath working for Edge magazine. We had members on the email thread representing Eurogamer, Gamesmaster, Official Xbox Magazine, Xbox World, and others. Hardship strips away the illusion of absolute self-reliance. I needed them, and I'm not unmoved reflecting upon the fact that they were needed and relied upon me in return. "Hello," wrote Eurogamer's Ollie Welsh in his first and only missive to the group. "Wow, I'm nowhere. Talk to me about humanity. As in, why would I cash it in and apply it to my character rather than just keeping it as items for when I want to reverse hollow slash Kindle? And what's the point of reverse hollowing, apart from being able to Kindle?" Quote, "Hey dude, I'm not sure yet," responded Matt Lees, then employed by Official Xbox Magazine UK, just 14 minutes later. "There might be some bonuses to having lots of humanity, but at the moment it seems only important for Kindling. Could be that this is the new light black tenancy stuff, but I'm just guessing." The chain didn't always have a ready-made solution to offer, yet it was comforting simply to know that you weren't the only person scratching your head in raw confusion. My earliest contributions to the list involved a bunch of moaning about contracting multiple stacking curses from the basilisks in the depths. I called them frogs at the time, I had no idea what they were. I mentioned to the group having received a pop-up message telling me to visit a healer in some place called Londo or something. Londo! Even if I'd known it was the new Londo ruins I meant to be looking for, I didn't know where they were located. I was lost. My hopes had diminished to the point where I started telling colleagues at work that I was likely going to have to create a new character and start the quest over from the beginning. From Simon Parkin, sent 28th of September, 2011, 12:50. "Hey, Team DKS. Any tips on those bastard bell gargoyles on the chapel roof? I get both of them down to about a third health, and they tag-team me till the end of all time. Managed to cut the tail off one of them, too, which I'm guessing is how you get his magic weapon drop? I don't have any magic at the moment, so I'm thinking maybe this could help me. Anyone know where I can buy some offensive magic, or am I too early on for that? XXXO." From Rich McCormick, sent 28th September, 2011, 12:53. "Yo, Simon, save the Sun Knight in the church first, then turn human before you climb the tower. Sun Knight will be summonable outside, and he distracts the gargoyles enough to let you swamp them with arrows or magic. I managed to take the first one down before the second one had even finished his I'm here animation this way." From Simon Parkin, sent September 28th, 2011, 2320. "Thanks, everyone. Took the Xbox offline, unhollowed, and there was a summon sign right there waiting for me. Did it first attempt. Kapow! Helped that I just picked up a badass Drake sword drop from the red dragon on the bridge. You can shoot its tail off from underneath the bridge. 200 attack damage as a base stat, and a ranged heavy attack move. Amazing. Where's best to head now? Down into the creepy woods, or back into the horrible town in an effort to ring the second bell?" One of the most surreal days of my entire career in game journalism was the one in which I'd spent roughly 8 hours camped in front of an old TV in the edge corner of Future Publishing's Bath editorial office, trying to get from the Firelink Shrine bonfire to Ingward atop the church in New Londo ruins. Since my numerous curse stacks had left me with 1/8 of a health bar, I could only take one or two blows before dying. It was a mind-numbingly tedious ordeal, and I went home that evening having failed to accomplish my objective. A work day that would have been utterly squandered if I hadn't been able to squeeze a few drops of anecdotal nectar from it just now. From Software would eventually consider curse stacking and patch it out of the game. Miyazaki himself confided to me later while I was in Tokyo researching a From Software profile for Edge that he believed they'd overreached. The studio's QA players had apparently become so adept at the game that they'd lost some connection with the reality of how less experienced players would interact with it. Quote, "Regardless of going overboard with the stacking of the curse," he told me, "we believe we did a fairly good job of turning the player's gameplay into the story. Like with the On Orlando Dragonbow Archer, I wanted to place some obstacles that people would remember and talk about. But if you hit that character with a poison arrow, he will die if it isn't treated. Including these kind of cheap strategies, I want people to have fun with strategizing. I want the game to be memorable." I want specific things that we will think back on in the game, like that moment with the archer. He didn't worry. I'll never forget my thrice-cursed predicament. If anything, I'm almost sad that the particular peninsula of despair has crumbled away from Dark Souls and slid into the ocean. I can describe it to future players, but they'll never set foot there. When you have stories, even traumatic ones, especially traumatic ones, there's a natural compulsion to get those stories out. From Jason Killingsworth, sent 21st September 2011, 1816. My biggest time sink so far has definitely been the frog curse, little buggy-eyed shitheads. Spun my tires for an entire day trying to get the remediation on the roof in the ghost house in New Londo Ruins with a quarter of my health bar. Then I got cursed a third time and it halved again to 1/8 of its original health, which meant a single hit would kill me. Fortunately, I'd already killed the gargoyles, so once I got the tip from a kind stranger on Twitter about the guy in the bell tower of the Undead Parish, I eventually managed to get through the Knights and Undead Mob without taking a blow. Don't get cursed. From Keza McDonald, sent September 21st, 2011, 1826. Jason, harsh luck on the cursing. Have you got a handle on how far through the game you are yet? It seems to just get bigger and bigger. I've been through Blightdown as a grinding break from the gargoyles, which has been giving me issues. From Matt Lees, September 21st, 2011, 1813. Currently grinding 4,000 souls to get this fucking curse removed. Tried running past the ghosts in Londo, but no chance. Don't like this curse stuff one bit. Not a fair or fun addition. The curse may have been broken to our detriment, but my comrades in the Chain of Pain uncovered separate balance issues that were broken in our favor, imparting to us godlike capabilities in the playground that would be Lordrun's launch day codebase. Rich M. boasted to the rest of us in the email thread that with a fully upgraded Titanite catchpole equipped, his offhand crystal ring shield was doing close to 900 damage in a single cast. Iron Flesh allowed us to cheese bosses such as the Four Kings and Gwyn by rendering ourselves almost invincible for several seconds in exchange for a trivial movement debuff. Those were the days. At times we struggled and gnashed our teeth, but at other times we got away with the most face-rolling tactics imaginable. September 21st, 2011, 12:37 p.m. I have just killed the gargoyles, writes Matt Lees, and I am fucking shaking. Reading Matt's exhilarated declaration now, several years later, I'm reminded of how special those moments truly were. For every Dark Souls player who sees the game's mastery curve all the way through, there comes a point where it's almost impossible to think of an early game boss such as the Bell Gargoyles as anything other than a pair of flies to swat away. Yet watching them disintegrate the first time was an experience that once caused us to shiver in relief. Later that same day, Keza writes, "This sodding butterfly is doing my head in! Get it down to about 1/5 health, then lose timing for the dodges or fall victim to her laser death beam." Matt quickly deploys an airdrop of empathy and veteran wisdom. "Yeah, timing the dodges takes a few tries to get nailed. Remember to switch to double hand when it lands." At no point in the Chain of Pain did anybody cry spoiler. Hearing a colleague mention the name of a boss you hadn't reached yet sent an electric current racing down your spine. If anything, it meant the eventual confrontation with that boss even more climactic. If all the townsfolk in your village are whispering tales of some dreaded creature out in the woods, that only makes the experience of finally crossing paths with the beast all the more memorable. From Mitch Dyer, sent September 29th, 2011, 1:53. 2 hours of aimless exploring later, I've made no forward progress from the stone bridge, up high, bonfire, and Blighttown. I've climbed so many ladders. Where do I go? From Keza McDonald, sent September 29th, 2011, 2:03. When you spawn at that bonfire, turn around and head across the next stone bridge where the flame dogs and the skinless zombies are waiting for you. Beware the poison dart snipers. You want to get down from there. You're looking for ladders down to the swamp below. Once you get to the swamp, you're near the Blighttown area boss. Oh, and beware the swamp. It poisons you. I really hated this bit of the game. I got stuck there for hours, too. From Mitch Dyer, sent September 29th, 2011, 1759. Grinding and audiobooks, peanut butter and chocolate. One of the other unique aspects of our experience with the game is that we all had the specter of copy deadlines hanging over our heads. As a reviewer, you hope to complete the game in its entirety before writing your piece so that you have the most informed opinion possible. Nobody wants to grind their wheels on a mid-game boss for several days and then simply have to give up progressing in order to bash out a review that deftly conceals one failure. We all wanted to finish. Almost nobody did, as I recall, but that time pressure made the experience even more fraught. You were progressing through a world of indeterminate but clearly enormous size, wondering how to gauge if you were on track to finish in time. The first person on the chain of pain who claimed to have completed the game was a writer from the US called Ryan Tijalnik. He was the chief Sherpa of our morale group. I remember being stuck on the ceaseless discharge fight and emailing him trying to get a sense of how much further I had to go. I felt like I'd progressed quite a distance into the game at that stage, but when he volunteered the sequence of the various bosses coming up, I felt disoriented by how many names he'd plotted out. He mentioned something about an army of Taurus demons. I started to despair. I felt freshly humbled by the game's dizzying scale. From Keza McDonald. Sent September 21st, 2011, 1557. I love, love, love the way that Dark Souls, and Demon Souls before it, not only encourage, but actually require this kind of communication. I'm a fair bit behind now, trying my bestest to own the gargoyles, but no luck. I have yet to investigate the garden, so I reckon that's my next stop. Rich, I'm playing similar to you, but don't have a good bow yet. How many hours are we all at? I'm still struggling at 9. Hit a proper brick wall with Taurus, he took me a good 6 hours to kill. From Rich McCormick. Sent September 21st, 2011, 1609. I've got about 16 hours under my belt. Still not attempted the gargoyles properly. They're just too tough without a stock of hefty arrows. When I was attending primary school in Mission Viejo in California in the late 1980s and early 90s, knowledge about games was a very real social currency. The kid on the playground who knew the location of an illusory wall in The Legend of Zelda, even if he just learned it by reading a feature in Nintendo Power magazine, felt to the rest of us like a bona fide soothsayer, like a childhood equivalent of Varys from Game of Thrones, full of information that seemed to arrive on the breeze. The internet has devalued that kid's currency. Now you ask a Google search field and feel next to no thrill when the solution to your riddle issues forth like a TV dinner from the microwave. But here was Ryan, the cool kid informant on our virtual playground, revealing to us the whereabouts of a dope souls-grinding spot in Darkroot, just inside the enchanted door, where you could get enemies to chase you, and then, by tricking the AI's pathfinding behaviors, get them to leap like lemmings into the adjacent chasm. From Michael Gapper, sent September 25th, 2011, 1755. Unless I've missed something obvious, there's nothing in Darkroot for me besides 3 crystal golems and a 7-headed dragon who gobs water at me from the other side of the map. Advice welcomed. From Jason Killingsworth. Sent September 25, 2011, 1800. Have you ground the 20k souls for the Crest of Artorias? There are some killer items in the part of Darkroot behind that enchanted door. The stone armor made my life much easier. Okay, nothing in the game makes your life much easier, but it definitely made my life marginally kind of easier, relatively speaking. From Michael Gapper. Sent September 25th, 2011, 1801. I don't even know what the Crest of Artorias is. Is there some trick to getting through the door, or will that come later? From Keza McDonald. Sent September 25th, 2011, 1803. The door is just a shortcut. Don't worry about it too much, although it's a good grinding place if you're struggling. The way to Butterfly is just to the right of the door as you approach it, although you're eventually going to have to do Capper Demon. I'm now stuck in a mystical sky castle, unable to go anywhere and completely stumped by the double boss at the end. Brutal. During lunch with Hidetaka Miyazaki in London in April 2012, I asked him if his team had designed that Darkroot spot especially for grinding. He assured me they hadn't, but since players had discovered it on their own how to manipulate it for their gain, he didn't want to patch the AI behavior and steal something away that now belonged to the community. The members of our group were of two minds about the Darkroot grinding bonanza. Quote, "It's funny, I've been craving a good grinding spot," Jeffrey Matulef wrote to the group on October 2nd. "But now that I have access to probably the best one in the game, it feels like cheating. Now that I know it, I can't unknow it. After indulging by gaining 5 levels real quick and saving up for a couple spells, I figure I'm going to lay off it unless there's an absolute emergency and I need a purifying stone or something. I know it's stupid and my fault for looking into and then doing it, but I can't help but feel like it breaks the game a little bit." Like, I was stuck at level 27 forever, he continues, and any time I'd have more than 3k souls, I'd get nervous. Now I just think, ah well, I can get those at that spot. Then again, maybe the designers just put it in there on purpose to throw us a bone. I mean, why else charge so much to open a door that connects the toughest enemies to a bonfire? It's barely even a shortcut. You're all far too moral, Rich McCormick replies. I spammed 100k souls earlier to buy myself 1,000 poisoned arrows. The game's chucked all it's got at me. I'd be stupid to not hit back with both brain barrels. Hey, I was level 61 before I hit on Orlando thanks to that spot, added Mike Grapper. Morality, schmorality. Leveling oneself up to the point where you no longer feel threatened is always one option available to players. A few members of our party took that route. Others didn't. I don't judge anyone. You do what it takes and you do what you can. How could you possibly judge someone for wanting to feel strong after they've been made to feel weak and vulnerable for so long? It's merely the Dark Souls equivalent of a scrawny kid who tires of getting bullied and starts beefing up at the gym. He ain't cheating. Even though the Chain of Pain had its share of moaning and venting about the cliff-face angularity of Lordran's learning curve, we shared laughs as well. One day somebody is complaining about being forced to stumble about in the pitch blackness of the Tomb of the Giants, but the next you find in your inbox that one of the less inhibited members of the group has decided to plug the giant crow and firelink shrine with a barrage of arrows. From Michael Gapper, sent September 25th, 2011, 2151. Okay, so if you attack the bird at Firelink Shrine, he takes it until half his energy bar is gone, and then he flies off toward the undead berg. I am in pursuit, Control. From Rich Stanton, sent September 25th, 2011, 2152. We got a runner. From Keeza McDonald, sent September 25th, 2011, 2317. Don't kill that bird! He takes you back to the undead asylum later in the game. You need that bird! From Rich Stanton, set September 25th, 2011, 2322. I'd like to register an interest in whether that bird has been killed or not. I still grin reading that exchange. Dark Souls is so full of interesting interactions. Why wouldn't somebody become curious about whether or not you could provoke or outright kill the enormous bird in Firelink Shrine? Even though you can't kill it off due to its role in ferrying you back to the undead asylum, it's a marvelous nuance that From Software designed it to fly away toward the undead berg after tolerating a certain amount of aggression. It would have been so easy for it to just sit there without registering any damage, to be a plasticine pincushion. But that wouldn't have felt real. The fact that it took flight eventually made it seem alive. It only takes one piece of lazy design to puncture the immersion of a world like Lordran. We started out at the beginning of our Dark Souls journey, feeling angst over our failures, but I gradually noticed a bit of levity creeping in. We came to appreciate that one's allotment of respawns never runs out, which means the sting of death only lasts as long as you allow your ego to hold sway. I've restarted on 360 Retail, Rich S. writes on September 28th. Waltzed through the first section with nary a scratch, strode up to the Tars Demon thinking, this punk doesn't know who he's messing with. And his first baseball swing sends me flying perfectly through the narrow gap in the wall. Home run for Team Demon. When will I learn? We're always learning in Dark Souls. We never stop learning. The more good-humored you are while taking that medicine, however, the more fun you will invariably have scaling Mount Mastery. Dark Souls feels smaller and smaller every time you play it, says Mike Gapper, when I reach out to a few of my former co-adventurers to solicit reflections on the Chain of Pain and that first dance with Lordran. Quote, it's not just the shortcuts either, but how you come to perceive the difficulty. Just getting to the bonfire in the Undeadburg was an hour's journey on that first attempt. Today it's a 2-minute walk. You're constantly asked to reinterpret the space in Dark Souls' world as your skills, equipment, and shortcut options increase. It always feels new. Looking back on the Chain of Pain, it's as foreign to me now as it was then, says IGN editor Mitch Dyer. Dark Souls is such a different language, a different kind of literacy, than any other game. Discovery is obviously hugely important to what makes it special, and I think sharing those discoveries with each other was really what made it feel like we'd legitimately found something. People couldn't wait to discuss their findings, to share a strange anecdote, to ask an insane question. Everyone who ever plays Dark Souls for the first time is entirely out of their element, and it's amazing to see how rapidly they become literate in its ways. It's a true trial by fire, but as a group experience, it's endurable. Matt Lees, who now makes witty and insightful videos about games under the banner Cool Ghosts, had a tighter deadline for his review than the rest of us, but seeing the thread unfurl like climbing a vine drove home just how special the game was. Quote, by the time these email chains, shared whispers between just a few people, merged into one megagroup, he recalls, I was almost done with my review of the game. My deadline was tighter. I was going on holiday. Scanning through this incredible quantity of secrets I'd missed and things I'd failed to glean was an eye-opening moment, and one that made me feel far more confident about the written review that I'd already sent to print. Dark Souls was a deep, strange, obtuse masterpiece. The sunny holiday that followed couldn't have been timed better, after a streak of horribly long days spent in increasingly dark and horrid locations. The wonderfully oppressive world of Dark Souls has always been my most professionally testing review to date. That first playthrough felt like a trial at times, something to be endured. Kiza still refuses to play any Souls games before release. I was being asked to work for my reward, and the more one is forced to struggle in pursuit of something, the more inclined one is to value it. But there's also an aphorism that many hands make light work. We didn't have online co-op summoning available to us playing that offline review build of the game, but we became supporting hands in other ways. Hands applauding one another, hands clasped in solidarity, hands palms up offering every secret we'd accidentally learned and couldn't wait to share. From Ryan Talgenic. Sent October 3rd, 2011, 8:10. Well, folks, after 100-plus hours between all my characters, I'm happy to report that I finally beat Dark Souls. Holy crap, what a ride. Have fun with the final boss. He's quite the jerk. Good luck. From Simon Parkin. Sent October 3rd, 2011, 9:16. Grats! New Game Plus, playing as a deprived beckons. From Rich McCormick. Sent October 9th, 2011, 12:43. Has anyone had any luck invading other worlds? I'm dressed like the Grim Reaper and wielding a semi-scythe thing, so of course I want to terrify some small child. A Tour of Lordran. Undead Burg and Undead Parish by Jason Killingsworth. In a game like Ocarina of Time, it feels comic and strange wandering into people's homes and smashing their belongings to bits, casting about for a spare rupee or five. Dark Souls Undeadburg revels in such therapeutic vandalism. Humanity has long since abandoned living in these hovels located just up the hill from Firelink. Most are devoid of furniture, containing only storage receptacles such as barrels, buckets, and burlap sacks. When you do a barrel roll, reducing a cluster of them to splinters with a single diving somersault, the natural echo chamber created by the vacant room and stone surfaces makes the din reverberate like a thunderclap. Undeadburg benefits hugely from Dark Souls' refusal to slather music like mood mayonnaise over every second of the experience. Lordran feels lonelier and more evocative when the music fades and the sounds of nature, gustling wind mostly, occupies the cavity left behind. At one point, this hamlet would have been filled with the sound of life carrying on. The contrasting silence of the present moment underlies the area's slide into desolation. The hollow warriors prowling the streets might have lived in these houses before the world fell apart. Occasionally, the footfall of one of them shambling down a nearby alleyway might disturb the silence, but that's about it. You also notice a recurring theme in From Software's visual design. Undeadburg maintains a homogeneous veneer. Structures blend into one another. Mossy stone facades, mossy stone arches, mossy stone footpaths, even wooden architectural features like beams and joists receive the same sickly greenish patina. I'm willing to allow for the possibility that this might simply owe to the need for being economical with your team's efforts when filling a big old world with stuff, recycling textures and other objects to make the furnishing effort feasible, but one of the byproducts is that you increase the level of challenge involved in navigating the space. There are fewer distinct features by which to orient oneself. Levels in Souls games are famous for the way they fold and double back on themselves, like one of those guinea pig mazes with the colored tubes. I'm convinced that Souls level designers want to help you lose your way by spacing out potential landmarks by which you might orient yourself. Just another obstacle to overcome. It's also time for our first encounter with the Hellkite Dragon. As you crest a flight of stairs midway through the burg, he touches down briefly on the bridge before flapping away to take up his perch near a loftier bridge beside the Altar of Sunlight. This initial encounter makes the world of Lordran feel dynamic early on, as it disrupts the perception of the world having actors occupying fixed marks. I strongly suspect that fantasy games have a time-to-first-dragon sighting metric that has to be kept below a certain threshold in order to assure fans of the genre that dragons are indeed present. Dark Souls' liberal borrowing from religious tradition and observance is most clearly apparent in the Undead Parish, for obvious reasons. There's the faith attribute you must level up to cast miracles. There are churches and cathedrals and shrines and altars littered about. Your character's animation while resting at a bonfire resembles a kneeling genuflection before a sword whose hilt creates the illusion of a cross. The game's preoccupation with the tension between light and dark finds an ally in religious mythology, and the undead church in the undead parish keeps Lordran's mystical qualities top of mind. Of the two bells of awakening in Dark Souls, the one players typically ring first is housed in the tower on top of the undead church, guarded by a pair of boss gargoyles. In terms of emotional reward, it's poignant how the game ushers you to the top of this tower and treats you to a gorgeous skybox view of Lordran as you celebrate one of the first key milestones in your quest. This corner of Lordran looks sylvan and regal from up high. For a few seconds, it's easy to forget what life is like down on the ground. And amidst so much rot and nihilistic quiet, sending the simple chime of a bell echoing across the burg feels hope-giving. You'll have to pass through the lower undead burg before you reach the entrance to the depths. The cramped, windowless domiciles in this area were presumably designed to help apartment dwellers in urban centers like New York City feel marginally better about their own accommodations. It feels like a joke, a door that opens into an unfurnished brick enclosure the size of a garden shed. I try and fail to imagine residents squatting inside. Crowd Sorcery. Twitch Plays Dark Souls by Keza McDonald. From the beginning, Dark Souls has been a shared experience. No one person passes through Lordran unassisted or unhindered by others. Whether those others appear in the game as phantoms or leave their echoes behind in messages and bloodstains. Even the act of looking up a wiki is participating in the communal experience of Dark Souls, drawing on someone else's hard-won knowledge to alleviate your own suffering. Together, Dark Souls players not only figured out how to actually finish the game, but have also pieced together the story and puzzled out its secrets. Dark Souls has always been multiplayer in all sorts of ways, but in August of 2015, that word would take on a whole new meaning. What would happen if thousands of people played Dark Souls not only at the same time, but effectively with the same controller? Twitch Plays Dark Souls is probably the craziest thing that anyone has yet tried to do with this extraordinary game. It turned Dark Souls into what's become known as a crowd play experience, following in the footsteps of Twitch Plays Pokemon, which had become a bona fide internet phenomenon the previous year. Here's how it worked. Tuning into a live broadcast of Dark Souls via Twitch TV, the enormously popular service that allows anyone to stream themselves playing a game online, for anyone to watch, spectators would use the chat window to input commands. A script would process these commands before enacting them in-game, resulting in absolute chaos as a single chosen undead responded to hundreds or thousands of button presses at once. Even the simplest actions became near impossible, and given that this was Dark Souls, not much was simple to begin with. For hours, days even, players flailed hilariously around the undead asylum, trying to defeat such diverse and challenging foes as ladders, doorways, and cliff edges, with no success. For minutes at a time, they'd roll continuously into the corner of a cell, accidentally open up menus and unequip their weapons, hack at a wall until their weapon broke. It was ridiculous. At one point, they almost got to the Asylum Demon's lair before some joker managed to equip the Dark Sign, which sent them right back to the first bonfire over and over again every time it was used. For hours. It was excruciating. Twitch Plays Dark Souls was sent up by a 27-year-old engineer called Daniel Nichols, who had been playing around with programming in his spare time. Given that he was both working full-time and pursuing a PhD, that spare time was precious. He had personally played Dark Souls the year before after it was recommended by an enthusiastic friend. He wrote the script in an obscure programming language called AutoHotkey, and it worked by reading chat from the Twitch channel and translating it into both commands for the game and text on screen so that people could see what was happening. Quote, "It was a, can I do this kind of a thing, to see if it worked," he says. Which it did. It just didn't produce any useful results in the beginning. Every single command was executed. It was all done simultaneously. And it was all multi-threaded, so it's possible someone could hit forward and back at the same time and you just wouldn't move. And it was not designed for the amount of people that were in there. On the first night, game website Kotaku posted an article about it and it just blew up. The next day we hit 15,000 players at one point and it was just crazy. I wrote this thing to handle like 50 people. At first, Twitch Plays Dark Souls would spend hours just trying to climb a ladder in the Undead Asylum to escape a teensy pool of water. This went on for so long that players jokingly began to worship the pool of water as their god in chat. It was entertaining to watch, and for a while it seemed like it would be impossible for them to even reach the game's first boss, let alone defeat it. It was more likely that the asylum demon would die of old age. Once, they managed to reach the boss and land a single blow, cause for rapt jubilation. They created several different characters, starting again each time, and the stream was getting nowhere. After 6 days, Daniel started to worry that it would never get anywhere. Seeing that people were starting to get bored and frustrated, he had to change the rules. The first thing he tried was implementing a democracy mode, something that Twitch Plays Pokemon had resorted to as well in order to make progress. Essentially, everybody would keep typing in their suggestions for what should be done next, and after a few seconds, the script would determine which command had the most votes. But that didn't work either. By the time the voting window was over and everyone had decided to roll out of the way of a Hollow's incoming sword swipe, the player would already be dead. The only solution was to implement a delay, pausing the game for 5 or 10 or 30 seconds whilst everyone decided what to do next. Superficially, the delay made Twitch Plays Dark Souls much less entertaining to watch. It would take minutes to do something that would normally take no time at all, like walking across a room, but vitally, it allowed Twitch Plays Dark Souls to start making progress. And in dramatic moments, the bizarre stuttering action could actually become even more dramatic. The game would pause agonizingly just as the Asylum Demon's giant hammer was about to smash the player into the ground, and you'd see thousands of people typing "Roll, roll!" into the chat window, scrolling past at 100 miles an hour. Dark Souls boss fights are already heart attack inducing, but watching Twitch Plays Dark Souls take on the Asylum Demon had me watching through my fingers. Remarkably, within a few hours of Daniel implementing the delay, they'd beaten it. It was an astounding victory. The final moments were almost impossible to bear. The player character throws his last fireball, and it misses the Asylum Demon by centimeters, landing in front of its right leg. Then the hammer comes crashing down, and both demon and player are left with a tiny smidgen of health. Scrambling toward the demon as it readies another hammer swing, the players manage to get in one pathetic little swipe of the axe, and it's just enough to bring him down. The chat channel went absolutely mental. In the voice chat room, where Daniel and some other volunteer moderators had been running the stream, things went equally crazy. Viewership had dropped to maybe 900 at that point, and we'd had 15,000 a few days before, but finally, they get to the Asylum Demon, and it took them 50 minutes or something on that last attempt, and it was just so close. So close! I mean, we had a sliver of health, the demon had a sliver of health, everybody losing it, and by the end, people just blew up. There were about 5,000 people in that room. We had drawn all those people from the woodwork to come and celebrate, and it was amazing. Everyone just lost it. Just lost it. It seemed unbelievable at the time that Twitch Plays Dark Souls had managed even this, the first and most basic challenge that Dark Souls has to offer. Right afterward, they started on their way to the Undeadburg, toward the game proper, and it turned out that actually traversing Lordran was going to be just as difficult as felling any of the bosses. Staying on the path up the cliff whilst Hollows chucked firebombs, even with the delay in place, proved to be comically difficult. I think deep in our hearts, nobody watching or playing expected Twitch Plays Dark Souls to get much further. The Asylum Demon was behind them, but think what was ahead. Sen's Fortress, the Four Kings, Tomb of the Giants, Ornstein and Blimmin Smo. But on they went. Progress was steady, even though it was taking hours to do what would have been a few minutes in a normal game. Boss after boss fell, and Twitch Plays Dark Souls started exploring the further reaches of Dark Souls together. When it was time for Sen's Fortress and its bastard swinging blades, I expected them to give up. If they couldn't manage a cliffside path without incident, how the hell were they going to get across those walkways and make it to the bonfire on top of the fortress? Surprisingly, though, sends turned out to be one of the less stressful areas for them. Quote, "Yeah, they got really, really good at that at some point," says Daniel. "There was one person in the chat that was really good at timing it, and he was using very short commands, because depending on the command, it waits longer between the pauses. He was using short commands to wait until it was the perfect moment and then rolling forward and passing, like, the two blades at once. It was definitely awesome to watch, because they'd roll when the blade was right in front of them." Then, on September 11th, 2015, Twitch Plays Dark Souls beat Ornstein and Smo. Like the fight against the Asylum Demon, it was fist-eatingly tense. Out of Estus, with a tiny bit of remaining health, after several nerve-shreddingly close attempts, they somehow managed to duck underneath Smo's hammer and land a final blow. Daniel, at the time, was astounded. Quote, "Ornstein and Smo is widely considered the hardest boss fight in the game. I was amazed they beat them," he told me the day after it happened. It's just a matter of time now. Felt like Twitch Plays Dark Souls really might make it all the way to the end. One of the funniest things about Twitch Plays Dark Souls is how it turned Dark Souls' difficulty on its head. Suddenly, the most feared enemies in Lordran were not gigantic demons or vicious undead, but bridges. Quote, "It takes some things in the game that are easy and makes them harder, and then it takes some things that are hard and makes them easier, because you've got time to vote. You don't have to make split-second decisions," says Daniel. "You know, you get stuck on bosses. That's why Dark Souls is so asynchronous. Why, you can go to another boss or area and work on that if you're having trouble elsewhere." But Twitch Plays Dark Souls didn't really get stuck on bosses. They got stuck on walkways. There was one boss they got properly stuck on, though. After Ornstein and Smo had fallen, the foe they had the most trouble with was one that's probably the easiest in the game, if you know what you're doing. Ceaseless Discharge. Of course, pretty much everyone in Twitch Plays Dark Souls knew what they were doing, but there was a constant push and pull between players who wanted to draw the boss off his precipice for an easy win, and those who wanted to take on the massive magma creature toe-to-toe. Quote, "They probably had 100 attempts at Ceaseless," laughs Daniel. "They were trying to cheese him, getting him to fall off the cliff. I probably watched 20 or so attempts. They tried many points in the game. They'd keep going back when they were stuck somewhere else." As they progressed through Lordran, it became clear that Twitch Plays Dark Souls wasn't just interested in finishing the game. Collectively, they were hitting every shortcut, every secret. They were even managing to keep Knight Solaire alive. At any time, there was always someone, if not a few hundred people, amongst the thousands of watchers and players who knew exactly what to do. When the very first group of players embarked upon Dark Souls, they were doing so without any of the knowledge that Twitch Plays Dark Souls' many participants had accumulated in the intervening years. The shortcuts, the techniques, the intimate knowledge of Lordran and every boss's attack patterns. Watching Twitch Plays Dark Souls was like watching the entire collected knowledge of the Dark Souls community play out, minute by minute. Pretty early on, they developed a winning strategy. Big weapon, suicidal enthusiasm. Helpful sorts edited together the footage of Twitch Plays Dark Souls boss fights to remove the long pauses, and watching them play out in real time is like watching a very drunk person play Souls. There's so little caution. Instead, there are wild swings of the weapon, desperate and directionless rolling, Estus chugging right in the middle of the action. This strategy was crucial to their progress. Because we had the Zweihander, we hit really hard when we hit. It was sometimes a quarter of the boss's health, Daniel explains. So some bosses became very easy, because you only had to hit about 8 times. People would vote to just chug Estus and flail wildly. They had the most trouble with bridges and small walkways. Walking forward was a big deal. A little bit of knockback from a minor enemy and you go flying off the bridge. After Ornstein and Smo, it felt like Twitch Plays Dark Souls was flying through the game. Even the Four Kings went down easy. The latter half of this game flew by, Daniel agrees. It was just a steamroll. There were a few days where they got a couple of bosses in the same day. I was thinking Bed of Chaos was going to be crazy, but it didn't turn out to be anything they couldn't handle. 43 days in, Twitch Plays Dark Souls was approaching Gwyn and the final hours of their collective journey. As the end approached, viewers began to trickle in again, ready for the big finale. Quote, "We were all watching. It was like 4 a.m., remembers Daniel. I found it amazing that they brought Solaire all the way to the end. The fight itself was pretty crazy. We had another experience where the fight started with 300 people, and by the end there were 4,000 to 5,000 people watching. Zweihander in hand, they traversed the fog gate, Solaire by their side. As Gwyn charges forward with that flaming sword, their first lunge falls completely short, but the next few hits connect. Good old Solaire takes most of the punishment as they land a few more hits from behind the Lord of Cinder. In the end, it's not even a close call. With 3/4 of a health bar left and 17 Estus flasks in the bank, Gwyn falls to his knees. In real time, it took a couple of hours. Without the pauses, it was just 2.5 minutes of game time. It had taken them 43 days, 8 hours, 14 minutes, and 23 seconds. They had died 904 times on the way. In the end, Twitch Plays Dark Souls' monumental, unlikely victory felt oddly anticlimactic, even for those who'd been there since the beginning. Quote, "It went really quickly. I was surprised," said Daniel. "Some of the boss fights we had were 6 or 7 hours real time because of the pausing, but Gwyn was maybe 2 or 3 hours. But it would have been awful if I'd missed it." Daniel's favorite memory of the whole experience was actually the first proper victory, the Asylum Demon. "I will never forget that moment," he says. But that showdown with Gwyn wasn't quite how things ended. In fact, the true ending of Twitch Plays Dark Souls was, well, it was much more Dark Souls. The day after the stream had finished the game, Daniel decided to experiment. He opened up the game to some player versus player action. "I put the program in chaos mode so there was no pausing, and I just sat in the Undeadburg where everyone likes to duel," he said. "Some people from the chat would come in and duel the chaos that is Twitch Plays Dark Souls. They even managed to kill a couple people with that giant weapon. But then we had one person come in who I think must have hacked the game, and with one little stab we were fully cursed, frozen up, and dead. And that is how Twitch Plays Dark Souls ended." It was a fitting conclusion. Over 43 days of Twitch Plays Dark Souls, it was easy to become accustomed to just how crazy the entire endeavor truly was. Cred playing one of the hardest games of all time should have been impossible, but when you think about it, in a way, every one of us was Cred playing Dark Souls. We might have felt alone, down in the depths of Blighttown Swamp, but we never were. There were hundreds of thousands of others leaving messages, helping out, and building the trove of knowledge that Twitch Plays Dark Souls drew upon to make their victory possible. One thing's for certain, if Daniel hadn't made a change early on and made it possible for Twitch Plays Dark Souls to pause the game and vote on the action, it wouldn't have gotten anywhere. Quote, "I mean, it would have happened, but it would have taken years," said Daniel. "I don't think anyone would have hung around to watch that." It's been quite the experience for the 27-year-old engineer and student who set up the stream as an experiment. Quote, "It's been very entertaining," Daniel says, "but it's also very difficult to sit here and watch them struggle with very simple tasks and not just, like, grab the keyboard and do it for them." But as ever with Dark Souls, it was determination and collective spirit that saw them through. And, as it happened, amongst Twitch Plays Dark Souls' thousands of anonymous watchers and players was an unexpected one, Hidetaka Miyazaki, who first heard of the effort when it was in its early stages. Quote, "When I first viewed it, they were having a hard time," he told me. "They finally beat that first boss and made it to Lordran, but I didn't think they'd ever get it finished. It's wonderful that they did." And that's going to do it for today's reading of You Died, A Dark Souls Companion by Jason Killingsworth and Keza McDonald. Next week we'll have part 3. But in the meantime, please go follow the show on Twitter. That's @codex_radio. You can tweet messages at the show there, or you can tweet at me personally @endless_odyssey. And as always, you can email the show at codexpodcast@myriadtruths.com. Thanks so much for tuning in, everybody, and we'll see you next week.